Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Guy, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, I would like to welcome you to the 2009 Winfield C. Cook Constitution Day Address. The annual address is endowed to the generosity of Winfield C. Cook, a former Dickinson trustee. Each year, the Clark Forum invites a prominent public figure to campus to speak on a contemporary issue related to the Constitution. This event celebrates the United States Constitution while commemorating Dickinson's connection to it. Benjamin Rush, signatory of the Declaration of Independence, founded the college just days after the conclusion of the American Revolution. The college was named after John Dickinson, who signed the Constitution in 1787, and subsequently fought for its ratification under the pen name of Fabius. Previous Constitution Day speakers include Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist, Judge Marjorie O. Rendell, Kenneth Starr, and speaking at last year's address, Tom Garrity. Introducing this afternoon's speaker, former Governor of Pennsylvania and former Secretary of Homeland Security Thomas J. Ridge, is the Honorable Judge John E. Jones. An alumnus from both Dickinson College and the Dickinson School of Law, Judge Jones began his legal career as a law clerk to the President Judge of Schuylkill County. In 1994, Governor Ridge named Judge Jones co-chair of his transition team, and in 1995 nominated him to serve as chairman of the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. Judge Jones held this position for 7 years, and in 2000 he received the Government Leadership Award from the National Commission Against Drunk Driving. In 2007, Judge Jones presided over the famous case Kitzmiller v. Dover, which dealt with teaching intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in public schools. He was recently named one of the 25 most influential graduates from Dickinson College. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session following Governor Ridge's speech. Because this event is being taped, and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming the Honorable Judge John E. Jones.
Thank you, Andrew, for that wonderful introduction. And it's wonderful to be here, of course. This is not the first time that I've had the honor of introducing my dear friend, former Pennsylvania Governor and Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge. But it is a particular honor for me to present him to my alma mater. And as I prepared this introduction, it occurred to me that for a college freshman, even if you're a native Pennsylvanian, Tom Ridge is likely someone you recall, but your memory may be somewhat indistinct. You were but 3 years old when he was elected governor of Pennsylvania, and not even born when, before that, he was elected to his first term in the United States Congress. Now, I'm sure that you'll recall the searing horror of 9/11/2001, but at that time, you were of an age when you may not have understood fully the way America changed on that day. And you likely do not remember that shortly thereafter, Tom Ridge was called to Washington to lead our nation's defense against an enemy unlike any that we had ever faced. So my challenge then is how to introduce you in a fairly short period of time to this remarkable man. Now, I think you should know these things about my friend. Tom Ridge was raised in public housing in Erie, Pennsylvania. He excelled both academically and athletically, and he earned a scholarship to Harvard. After 1 year at the Dickinson School of Law, he was drafted and he served a tour in Vietnam. There he saw combat. He returned to law school with great honor and numerous decorations. After practicing law and serving as a prosecutor, a career in Congress, as I said, followed. He then ran successfully for governor of Pennsylvania in 1994. This was an unprecedented feat for someone in the far northwestern corner of the Commonwealth. In 2000, Governor Ridge was on George W. Bush's very short list of running mates, something he replicated last year with Senator John McCain. In mid-2001, Governor Ridge looked with great enthusiasm towards the last year and a half of what had been a remarkable and successful tenure as governor of Pennsylvania. He was ready for the next chapter in his life, which would likely be, at least for a time, a return to the private sector. As he details dramatically in his terrific book, The Test of Our Times, Governor Ridge began the day on 9/11/2001 at home in Erie, Pennsylvania. Like the rest of us, he had no sense of what that day would bring. Later, after the Twin Towers collapsed in flames, the Pentagon was hit, and United Flight 93 nosedived into a field near Shanksville, he returned in a state police helicopter to Harrisburg. In just weeks, he would be tapped to lead the nation's homeland security efforts by President George W. Bush. And within several months, he would be given the responsibility to organize and serve as the first secretary of a new and unprecedented cabinet department, the Department of Homeland Security. In Governor Ridge's book, which I would suggest to you is a must-read for anyone who wants to understand not just where we've been on the terrorism front, but also the changes that lie ahead and how to deal with them, he details his last address to the Pennsylvania General Assembly before departing for Washington. I remember it well, as I was there on that very emotional day. I did not know, however, at that time, that my friend had steeled his own nerves with something, a trick that he performed, and this provided him with great focus. He did it in the following way. He took a note card, and he printed four large words on the note card, cognizant of the fact that those forces who would do ill to the United States were watching him. The four words that he wrote are, "The bastards are watching." Tom Ridge served as Secretary of DHS until 2005. As he was fond of telling me while he was there, failure was not an option. He also frequently quoted British scholar Paul Wilkinson, who said, "Fighting terrorism is like being a goalkeeper. You can make 100 saves, but the only shot that people remember is the one that gets past you." Well, as our nation's metaphorical terrorism goalkeeper, Tom Ridge pitched a shutout. Today, Governor Ridge has brought his intelligence and drive to the private sector, where he has founded Ridge Global, an international company consulting on security, risk management, and technology integration. He serves on numerous public and private boards, including the Hershey Company. I hope you'll allow me a personal indulgence as I conclude this introduction. I have enjoyed some personal successes in my life, and I have had the privilege to engage in public service for a number of years. But as I have frequently said, whatever I have accomplished in public life, it is largely due to the friendship, to the inspiration, the guidance, and the support of this man. For among his many spectacular qualities, this one stands above the rest. He never, ever forgets his friends. I am so proud and honored that he has been repeatedly described as a mentor to me, and there are none better. When former President Bush dramatically introduced our guest to a packed joint session of Congress weeks after 9/11, he said this, "And tonight, I also announce a distinguished American to lead this effort to strengthen American security, a military veteran, an effective governor, a true patriot, a trusted friend, Pennsylvania's Tom Ridge." I can hardly say it better about my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you an American hero, Governor Tom Ridge.
You've always been too good to me, huh?
Been too good to me.
Well, that was quite an introduction for my friend. Overly generous. A very proud alum of the school, which has sent to public service in the private sector many proud alums, so I'm grateful for the invitation and to be introduced by somebody that actually, Judge Jones, then chairman of the Liquor Control Board, I had a couple big initiatives that I really wanted to promote in the state, And he was so good that they made it impossible for me to do one of them. I really wanted to sell the liquor control board. I want liquor stores. But I asked him to come in and run it like a business. But what you don't know about the judge, he's a very, very accomplished lawyer beforehand, before he became elevated to the bench. Great businessman, great business sense. And he came in and he started running like a business, made a profit, did a lot of things. Nobody wanted to dispose of the liquor store. So more importantly than all of that, he is brings to this school, to his profession, to his family, and to his community, gives great credit because he's a remarkable individual and a dear friend. And Andrew Guy, I want to thank you for, one, the fascinating interview that you and I just conducted. I guess it's on the school's radio. I encourage you to listen to it. He did a heck of a good job. I appreciate the thoughtfulness of the questions and the thoroughness of them, and appreciate your participation as well in the forum. My thanks to Dickinson College and to all of you who have gathered here tonight. I must say that I saw so many students coming in, and I said, "Do you get credit for showing up?" And the vice president said, "No, they're all volunteers." And so I don't know how many of you are interested in the World Series, but I assure you I'm not going to talk past 7:57. I assure you, if I even came close to that, I'd get the look and the signal from some of my friends that it's time to conclude. I want to thank the judge for talking a little bit about my public service career. And I just want to say at the outset, I hope that some of you in this audience, the students, consider it as a career for yourself. And I don't necessarily mean an elected office. Government's a service industry. To a certain extent, it's a business. And those of us who are elected, and those of us who serve on the bench, and those who serve in the agencies and bureaus of government, their job is to try to deliver in the most effective and efficient way the services that you ask your government to provide. So we need talent. We need people who believe that public service is a noble venture. I happen to think it is, since I spent most of my life doing it. That it's worthwhile, that it's rewarding, and indeed it is rewarding. Oh, there are probably bigger paychecks elsewhere, but when you start solving problems for a broader community beyond yourself or your family, you got to feel pretty good about that. And the government will always be in the need of Andrew economists and biologists and engineers and lawyers. So as you're thinking about a career path down the road, let me just put in a plug for public service. And too much attention is paid to individuals such as yours truly because I've been fortunate enough to hold elected office. But the hard work of government is done by literally hundreds of thousands of people whom you've never met, who every day try to make your country safer, more secure, more effective, more efficient. So down the road, as you're thinking about a career path, I hope you think of public service. It's an honor to serve as your Constitution Day speaker, and it's certainly an honor to join you this evening. Forums such as this are where ideas are put through the crucible of debate. I hope my conversation, beginning the conversation with you tonight, is provocative enough that when we get done with this, we have a little Q&A and a little discussion, and we'll take the conversation wherever you go. Hopefully, my remarks will stimulate some of that. But here's where ideas are put through the crucible of debate. You hold them up for review, see if you can develop a consensus, challenge and improve them. That's the nature of, I think, colleges and universities anyhow, isn't it? Ideas kicked around, challenged, refined. Well, hopefully we can do some of that tonight. Now, we all know that the great ideas of one age do not always survive the next age. But freedom and the desire for it, the living and breathing and opportunity of it, has survived. And that surprises no one who has enjoyed the benefits of freedom, including the benefits and the guidance set forth in a 230-plus-year-old document called our Constitution. Now, those blessed with the gift of liberty, in my judgment, are forever charged with the duty to preserve it. We're also charged with furthering the security and prosperity that generations before us have made possible in our lives. We're also charged with managing the vast and rapidly changing American frontier. All of us, whether you're in public service or not, are accountable for the risks we take, the opportunities we embrace, and the outcomes we deliver. We're charged to do this and more in a manner that is consistent with both the prerogatives and protections of the Constitution of the United States. When we consider the change that has occurred in the world, it is both comforting and, I dare say, remarkable that our Constitution, our system of government, is still relevant, still upheld by citizens. And despite some missteps, and it's not a perfect system, we're not a perfect country, our Constitution still engenders a desire for democracy in other parts of the world. In 1776, we said no to monarchy and yes to liberty. And as a consequence, a newly formed America established its own place in this world and made something of its freedoms, its inspiration, and its desire to prosper. Now, more than a couple of centuries later, on September 10th, 2001, most Americans were feeling good about our place in the world as a strong, unchallenged nation with a strong and expanding economy. Think about it. The Cold War had ended. The Soviet Union was no longer a threat. A new Europe was emerging, and more countries were looking to build civil societies around democratic principles. While the ugliness and brutality of terrorism was viewed as an unseemly part of the modern world, with the exception of Oklahoma City and the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, radical violence occurred over there beyond our borders. It really wasn't on our radar. We weren't paying too much attention to it. We were a superpower. We enjoyed a standard of living unequaled in the world. We had friends to the north and the south. We had oceans to the east and the west. We were safe, we were secure, and we wrongly concluded we were immune. We were immune from such horrific terrorist attacks. Since 9/11, we've let go of either that naivete or that arrogance, but we've let go of it. We understand in a most profound way that the threat is real for us. Terrorism is a tragic prologue. It is an unwelcome, but it is an immutable reality of the 21st century. It will challenge this country and the world, in my judgment, for the next several generations. Today, it challenges our way of life. But as we've seen in our efforts to regain our footing these last 8 years, issues of national security in a post-9/11 world also challenge us to look closely not only how we keep ourselves safe, but also how we keep ourselves safe in a way that is consistent with our values and our rule of law. As such, we know there are questions, good and appropriate questions, that deserve necessary debate. These questions span the threshold of government protections, the transparency of those efforts, how we balance security in accordance with the Constitution, and the careful caretaking of our liberties. Should law enforcement be given expanded authority to protect us? Are there areas where the executive branch can actually operate without legislative oversight? Is a national ID card an infringement on our right of privacy? Do biometrics invade our privacy or protect it? How do we adjudicate terrorists? What is an adequate level of security in a risk-managed world? What constitutes a legal encroachment in the context of national security? And the list goes on and on. A whole host of questions arose with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. It was the biggest change management challenge in organization of government since the Truman administration, and right after World War II is when they actually created the existing Department of Defense. Our mandate was to integrate people from over 20 different agencies of government, nearly 180,000 people, and at the same time we were trying to build the department, we were supposed to build a security platform to keep America safe. And we had to do it and to work within and across federal departments, with state and local governments, and with our international friends and allies. So you can well imagine. This called in questions of jurisdiction, federal authority, states' rights, international law, cultural differences, sovereign issues, and speed. There was a sense of urgency to do everything possible to fight an enemy who was literally invisible. And to build a more secure America at the same time, we were building a new department. And I will tell you from the outset, we asked ourselves within the department, whenever we thought about doing something different to make ourselves more secure, three fundamental questions. Will it make us safer? What is the economic cost associated with it? And I don't mean the cost of the technology, but is there an impact in our ability to compete around the world? Is there an impact in our access to that broader global marketplace? There is a cost if you ramp up security and make it more difficult for products and people to come across your borders. And perhaps if you want further explanation, I would be happy to amplify it during the Q&A. But are we safer? What's the cost? And the third question we always asked, is it consistent with the Constitution and the rule of law? It's that last question that I think is relevant to tonight's conversation. The nexus of security and the rule of law has both domestic and international dimensions. And for the purpose of the discussion this evening, I thought I'd just focus on a few. Ben Franklin once warned, and I paraphrase, we should not trade our essential liberties to purchase temporary safety. Interesting thought, isn't it? We do not trade liberty to purchase security. Now, with that notion very much in mind, Congress established two, I think, vital public protectors within the department by virtue of the Homeland Security Act. We had an officer for civil rights and civil liberties, and we had a privacy officer within the department. At the time, no other title such as these existed in any other federal agency in the federal government. It's pretty clear that at least someone in Congress, or those that helped draft the legislation, actually we did much of it in the White House, appreciated the notion that there may be an intersection where we're trying to enhance security. It may infringe upon, encroach upon the Constitution, and we better make sure that that doesn't happen. They established these two offices. The protection of privacy, interesting concept, of the dignity and the right of you as individuals, is not a value that you can add on to a protective measure. It's not a plug-and-play kind of thing. It's an intangible. The value is one that must be embedded in the organization and mindsets of people who create and enforce new policies. If we're going to do such and such a thing, if this is a measure we are going to undertake, does it infringe on the right of privacy that every citizen has in the United States? What I think is most interesting about this country's embrace of privacy laws is there's surely no stated right of privacy in the Constitution. Rather, over the course of many years, it has become a theme of our democracy, of democratic life, a universal recognition that has led scholars, legal scholars, to describe privacy as a penumbral right within the Constitution. Now, from that core belief, there has grown an institutionalizing of laws that protect and preserve the privacy of individuals. So protection of privacy is not something we any longer hope to accomplish. It is mandated by citizens and by government. Privacy and civil liberties are part of the intangible assets that the country seeks to protect, as well as the intangibles of life and country. I used to say to audiences when I was secretary, our job is to protect the tangible and the intangible. tangible, those physical things, those human things, you, your family, your community, the nuclear power plants, commercial aviation, that's tangible. But the other tangibles that we are obliged to protect is our value system, civil liberties, privacy, our freedoms. As a matter of fact, if you took a look at our vision statement, we didn't immediately talk about protecting the tangible. We talked initially about preserving liberties. Again, Ben Franklin's reminder, you don't surrender liberty to assure yourself or to give yourself some temporary security. Now, it is certainly understandable, and it's certainly relevant in the context of personal life in a contemporary society, that privacy and civil liberties are often at risk with personal data flows because of the nature of how we live, the information we give to each other. When you think about you and how you live today, your ability to identify and to assure people that you are who you say you are, and then you share information about you, there's a lot of information out there about you. Now, technically, it's private. Sometimes you surrender it voluntarily. And certainly in a post-9/11 era, fear of government abuse of information is understandable, but I don't think it can let us stop from what is doing right and respectful at the same time protecting it. So I think the antidote to fear about privacy is transparency. Whenever we deal with an issue that potentially infringes on your privacy, we have to talk about it publicly. We have to work together to ensure that our laws and programs appropriately use information, that we protect it from misuse, and that when we discard it, when of no further use. In the legal realm, it is a great debate in which we all should foist ourselves into the middle to the enforcement of the Privacy Act and the Freedom of Information Act compliance to ensure that technology gains are not privacy losses and to continue to assure the rights of the individual. How much information would you be willing to surrender in order to be more secure in either the course of the day or in the course of an activity that we might all engage in? We tried a pilot program that I thought could be very helpful, not only in terms of commercial aviation security, but in terms of getting a sense of what the public would share with government in an effort to make their life easier, but at the same time to make commercial flying safer. We did it with 3 airlines, 5 airports. Volunteers, so they were surrendering it voluntarily. Would you give us your iris scans, put in a database, so we could identify you are who you say you are? Would you give us your fingerprints, so we could run it against the database? I mean, we got a lot more information today about people around the world. The FBI's got a considerable database. We pick up other information so that we could just check your fingerprints against the database that we have. And then would you give us a certain amount of information, probably not as much as you give your credit card companies, but a certain amount of information so that we could conclude in a risk-managed world. Remember, we're not going to create a fail-safe society. We can't do that. We don't want to even try. But in a risk-managed world, you're probably not a terrorist. Would you surrender your iris scan, your fingerprints, and some background information so somebody could take a look at it and say, you're probably not a terrorist. Chances are 99.9 infinite that you're not a terrorist. Would you get on an airplane when everybody seated around you was vetted in that way? I would tell you, many people say yes, believe it or not. Some people say no. Well, as long as we're saying no and we treat everybody as a terrorist, we're going to continue to wait in long lines. Some people are quite content with that. I now stand in those long lines. One of the interesting changes about being a private citizen. Matter of fact, I've been called into secondary screening almost 2 dozen times. How many have been called into secondary screening? Do you believe the first Secretary of Homeland Security has been there almost 2 dozen times? By the way, when other passengers see me in that plexiglass lane, some of them just start laughing. The other adjustment, the only real adjustment from the public service to private citizen was transportation. One was commercial aviation. The other was the day after I resigned, my last day at work, I went down the steps because we started every day in the morning, 6:30 out the door, military aid, read my briefing book, White House briefing, CIA into the Oval Office with the president. There was a car at the bottom of the steps. I got up that morning. I wanted to go somewhere. No car. My kids have one car to school. My wife has the other car. I've got no car. How many of you, I'm talking to the older folks, how many of you ever borrowed a car from your kids? Now, don't you students do this to your parents, but I turned to my son. I said, Tommy, Dad needs the keys to the car tonight. I got to run to the mall. He looked at me, and he got that grin on his face. You know, you probably give your parents that grin from time to time. And your parents know, okay, now be respectful. Never age your well, be respectful. He flipped me the keys, and he said, okay, Dad, here are the keys. Watch where you park the car. And don't forget to fill it up with gas before you bring it home. Transportation, commercial aviation. Would you get on that plane? That's up not for you to decide now, but would you get on the plane? What kind of information do you want the government to know about you? The other example I use, and I'm not here to decide it tonight, what if your bookstore, maybe it's a local mom and pop, maybe it's Barnes & Noble, maybe it's Borders, whatever it is, you're an indefatigable reader. You love to read. And let's say you love histories. And Stephen Ambrose is one of your favorite authors, and he's got something come in, and the bookstore writes you and says, hey, we've got a new book coming out by your favorite authors. We know this is an area that you like to read. Here's a 20% coupon. Come on in. You'd say, boy, that's pretty clever. They know what I like. I'm probably going to use the coupon. I'm going to go buy it. Good marketing, good sales, good business. What if you get a note from your librarian, an agency of government? It says, we notice these are the books you like to take out of the library. We've got some new ones coming in. We just thought you ought to know that. They'll be available as of such and such a date. Do you feel good that an institution of government knows what you're reading? Not to answer that question, but the notion of privacy and what kind of information we're willing to share with the government in order to make us all a little bit safer is one that we're going to continue to wrestle with. I, for one, would get on that airplane. And I don't particularly care to know that the government knows what I'm reading. That's just my opinion. So I think this whole notion of public trust is now and should always be a work in progress. We should always be skeptical, challenge, and probe when the government wants to secure information from us. That's why security and privacy issues sometimes collide. There are a couple other examples that I would raise with you this evening for purposes of our discussion. Remember the Patriot Act? Great deal of criticism. And I don't view criticism and dissent as a bad thing. As a matter of fact, it's at the heart of America's system of government, isn't it? It's called First Amendment, I think. A robust, dynamic government faced with the challenges of post 9/11 era should move as quickly as it can, but as cautiously as it should, to make sure that the measures that it undertakes provide the security we need, but at the same time don't infringe upon our constitutional rights. The Patriot Act, there's a lot of bad information about that act. I, for one, don't think there was a single provision in the act that infringed on our rights as a citizen. I think it added capabilities that law enforcement had used in other areas that were not applied to combating terrorism. It tore down the wall. Believe it or not, before the Patriot Act, the law enforcement community could not share information with the intelligence community, and the intelligence community, particularly with overseas intelligence, couldn't share with law enforcement. It was a barrier. It was a legal barrier. The act broke it down. But the real story, I think, about the Patriot Act is that the Congress of the United States, as the Constitution says it should do, on a regular basis has gone back and revisited the provisions of the act every 2 or 3 years to make sure that certain provisions about which there was some skepticism and some concern early on did not result in the abuse that some people were concerned about. That's that transparency. That's that vigilance that I think is essential for us as a country to accept as part of how we deal with the post-9/11 world. You remember the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. There was a great deal of controversy around a program that President Bush initiated where when one of the parties' conversation was overseas, there were certain requirements, certain preconditions, then we have some fairly sophisticated intercept capability that we could listen into the conversation. You didn't have to go get a warrant to do it. Well, there was a great deal of public debate, as appropriate, about that process. The use of electronic surveillance and the applications of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, involved a search for more effective means to identify terrorist plots. It also invited debate, predictable constitutional debate, between two branches of government over power and authority. What presidential powers are inherent? What powers are authorized? And what congressional restraints can be imposed? It's quite interesting that last week, President Obama's administration followed the Bush administration in invoking the state secrets privilege regarding a case concerning a government electronic intercept. Attorney General Holder said that the privilege was being used only when absolutely necessary, but in this case, allowing the trial to continue would irrevocably harm the national security of this country. Rarely invoked. I have no idea what the facts were. One of the things I miss about not being secretary is I don't have all the information I used to have, don't know everything I used to know, even though most of it wasn't very pleasant. But I dare say someone concluded that divulging whatever information was relevant to this inquiry could have compromised either a bigger, larger investigation, a particular sort, a method of acquisition, I don't know, but they invoked that act. Historically, wartime presidents such as Washington, Lincoln, and Roosevelt have interpreted their authority as commander-in-chief to include the gathering of foreign intelligence without a warrant. Just to be clear, this terrorist surveillance program involves intercepting the international communications of persons reasonably believed to be members of Al-Qaeda, an affiliated terrorist organization. It is narrowly focused, narrowly focused, and fully consistent with the traditional forms of enemy surveillance found to be necessary in all previously armed conflicts. The challenge I had, and the question that I had, and I, as many of you know, the president was and still is a great friend of mine, is what, and I ended up siding with Congress, but they said, Mr. President, you really need to come up to the Congress of the United States. We need to amend the Foreign Intelligence Service Act so that what you're doing is consistent with the law that we passed when technology was entirely different. They passed a law 20-plus years ago, when the most sophisticated form of electronic surveillance was wiretapping. It was like this notion. There's some headlines in some of the more notable national newspapers, and they use the word wiretaps. Well, folks, these are very sophisticated computers, electronic intercepts. They're not necessarily listening in the whole context of the conversation, listening for phone numbers, listening for names, listening for key words. And based on that, they can get warrants and further their investigation. But you would think that the way some of the people spun the issue was that there was a sign outside your dormitory. There was on a catering van, and it said Ridge's Catering. Like I was listening in with earphones, and the tapes are going around and around. I'm listening to your conversation with your girlfriend or your grandmother or your boyfriend or your dad. I mean, that's not the way it was. So the technology moved quickly past the law. And the only challenge I thought that the president had, the responsibility I had, was to go up and work with the Congress of the United States so they understood when it was being used, how it was being used, so that they could exercise what I consider to be legitimate, constitutionally protected oversight of this particular presidential capability. One final thought with regard to domestic, and then just a few final thoughts, concluding thoughts with regard to international implications. During this whole debate, I actually had some Americans come up to me, some good citizens, well-intentioned people, and said, We don't care if the government listens into our conversations. We're not doing anything wrong. We're not saying anything we're ashamed of. There's no criminal activity, terrorism activity involved in what we're saying. At that point, I say, we got to stop. You don't voluntarily surrender what we have fought for and bled, died for 230 years. You don't protect it for centuries in order to forsake it just because of a concern about terrorism. I think it's really important that we remind ourselves of that. And it's equally important, and as we speak, this Congress of the United States is going back again for the third time to look at other provisions in the FISA Act to make sure that the abuses about which they were concerned have not materialized over the past couple of years of use. There was one occasion when one of those national security letters, which was a provision of the Patriot Act, I won't get into the details, we in the government discovered it. Somebody in the Department of Justice said, you are not following the requirements and the preconditions of the Congress of the United States, and it's kind of a whistleblower. Bob Mueller was informed of it. The FBI wasn't compliant, and he changed internally what we were supposed to do in order to be compliant with the congressional authority and responsibility to the legislative branch of government. This brings me to an issue that has global implications, but it's constitutional in origin. If America is a product, we try to sell ourselves around the world. We've been pretty successful over the years. We're very unique in many different ways. We're not perfect, but we're unique. But if America is a product, then our value system is a brand. And it's my judgment that in order to combat terrorism and be successful long term, we have to do it in a way that is consistent with that value system, with that brand, consistent with our Constitution. So this raises the whole specter of the debate on Guantanamo. I, for one, think the debate about the space, the place, the venue, kind of obscures the broader constitutional question. It obscures why the rest of the world has looked with jaundiced eye from time to time at the United States and at Guantanamo. I think most of us agree that a whole host of issues pertaining to the rule of law have arisen since the day that was first opened. At the time when it seemed necessary to do so, but not quite so clear what we were going to do with the enemy combatants once they were imprisoned there. I happened to have a friend who was involved in some of the early interrogations. Frankly, he told me that some of those folks that he interrogated should never be released ever, ever again. He also confided to me that some of the folks who were there were picked up and they were at the wrong place at the wrong time, and they shouldn't be there. Guantanamo has tested our legal system in new and formidable ways. How do we define a terrorist under our laws? They're not criminals in a traditional sense of the word. They're not protected, some have argued, under the traditional rules of the Geneva Convention as prisoners of war. Think about it. They are rogue individuals. They have no allegiance to a country or a flag, only a way of life. They are soldiers. Bought into a philosophy, an ideology, but their allegiance is not to a sovereign. So we call them enemy combatants. The question is not where we house them, but how we adjudicate them. I was having a conversation one evening with a friend of mine who held a similar position overseas in Germany. A lawyer who had protected political terrorists and had defended political terrorists in Germany. In the 60s and 70s, a lawyer who was proud of his relationship, proud to be supportive of America when a lot of people in Germany particularly weren't. A lot of Europeans were looking the other way. Well, he would stand up and talk about it publicly. But he said to me, and I knew it exactly what he meant, what are you going to do about Guantanamo? I'll be a little less diplomatic, but he basically said, America tries to encourage the development of democracy around the world. You talk about your country, you talk about your rule of law. Where is the rule of law as it relates to Guantanamo? You're going to keep them there forever? That's not American. I thought you had something in the United States called due process. Now, he wasn't saying the criminal justice system. He certainly wasn't saying the Uniform Code of Military Justice. He said, I'll never forget his words, in a transparent public way, that's the way Americans operate, sometimes to our detriment, but that's the way we operate, and we continue to do so. What's the form of representation and adjudication that you will provide for these individuals that you have at Guantanamo? And once that adjudication is completed, he thought and others thought the resentment or the concern that people had about Guantanamo wouldn't evaporate, but much of it would subside and some of it would diminish. Think about it. We've talked to the rest of the world about our Constitution and our rule of law. We proudly embrace the notion of due process. And so all of a sudden they look at us in a post-9/11 world and say, well, it's good, but it's not good there. It doesn't apply to those individuals. Well, again, if America is the product and the brand is our value system, it also sends a signal to the terrorists and those who would do us further harm that we can still operate as Americans while we're dealing with your horror and dealing with your potential actions. So at the end of the day, I think how we project ourselves to the rest of the world must be very positive, must be authentic, and it must be consistent with our own value system. I think our leadership and our credibility internationally depends upon our own ability and willingness to meet the mission of national security in a way that's consistent with the image we project and we promote. Now, those who doubt our ability to do so don't appreciate the vitality or the energy of our democracy, nor do they understand the value we gain by challenging and questioning our own actions. You know, America, we are our best cheerleaders. We are also our best and most formidable critics. There's a certain vitality to that notion because we're constantly challenging each other. We understand that now more than ever, homeland security is a very human endeavor shaped by millions of human actions. And how we carry out our response to it before the world will be tested. And whether we like it or not, as Americans, we will be held to a higher standard. We preach that we hold ourselves to a higher standard. From time to time, the world's going to hold us to it. I'm quite comfortable that we can live up to it. That is not a problem. But the endeavor must continue with a commitment to respect people's privacy, civil liberties, reputation, and the rule of the law. And I think honest dissent in debate is very important. I had an experience a couple weeks ago that really disappointed me. I was on another college campus. I'm not going to tell you where I was. It was actually with a graduate school, a bunch of graduate school students going to talk about my book, talk about leadership, talk a little bit about managing big institutions. And a couple undergraduates came in, and they raised so much havoc, so much dissent, so much discord, not dissent, couldn't have an honest disagreement, that we had to cancel the session. And I looked at one young man. I was very restrained. I was, quite frankly, very proud of myself. But he came to the front of the room, and he had his goofy-looking T-shirt on, all multiple colors, and this is what terrorism looks like. And I said, that's probably what your room looks like. It was just a mess. And I don't think he was a burgeoning artist or whatever he was. And I said, well, you know, if you want to see what terrorism looks like, go talk to Daniel Pearl's family. Want to see what terrorism looks like? Go talk to the families in Baghdad or the families in Afghanistan that lived under Taliban or rule or have been subjected to these jihadist terrorism. Go talk to one of the families of the 3,000 people that died in the Twin Towers. Go talk to Flight 93 families. So you don't get it. And the point I stayed afterwards and we just talked. The point I wanted to make is that the title of my book, Test of Our Times, is really not my test, it's the country's test, and that is how do we continue to balance the freedoms that are so dear and important to us, and at the same time, we combat the enemy. We can do it, but how we do it is the test of our times. And part of the test is that we are prepared to take that test, perhaps not on a daily basis, but from time to time when we think about how we're going to reach out and deal with a threat. And you can only deal with that if you have honest, transparent, thoughtful, responsible, civil debate. Obviously, the First Amendment didn't mean much to those folks because they shouted down everybody else and we concluded the session. It was too bad. It was more a statement about them than it was about anything else. So let me conclude by underscoring that these are uncertain times, a test of our times, but I don't think there's anything uncertain about the United States of America. Without question, since September 11th, our world has changed, America has changed, but much of what is important to all of us remains the same. America is still a welcoming nation, although I wish that we'd open the door a little bit further, that opens her borders to citizens from around the rest of the world. Our promise still rests on a respect for a vast diversity of people and cultures that enrich our lives every day. Freedom is still the hope of many, and terrorism is the choice of but an embittered few. Now more than ever, there's a level of preparedness and thus a level of security grounded in the purest notions of performance and outcomes, partnerships and patriotism, the preservations of our freedoms and our accountability to future generations. And with the passage of each day without incident, we do get a little smarter. We get more secure, and I suspect we get closer to that new piece of intelligence or technological discovery that makes us safer. This is the country our founders always hoped it would be. And today, I believe they would be proud of how we have responded. Americans don't live in fear. It's just not in our DNA. We do live in freedom. That's very much a part of each and every one of us. It's a legacy that we inherited, and it's a responsibility to pass it on to the next generation untarnished. That's why the continuing public debate, discourse, dissent around security and freedom is very much a part of not only the legislative and elected officials' responsibility, but it's yours as well to be engaged in that debate. We don't live in fear. We live in freedom, and I'm quite convinced we'll never let that freedom go. So it's been a great pleasure for me to share these thoughts with you. I'd like to take some questions if you have the time, and thank you for the invitation.
Secretary Ridge, thank you for coming here to Dickinson. Two-part question for you.
Are you studying journalism? Two-part questions.
What do you think is the United States' greatest vulnerability right now?
Okay.
And in all seriousness, considering all the information you had while you were secretary, how did you sleep at night?
First question, did you hear the questions? All right. I slept at night, I just didn't sleep much. That answers the second question. I'd said that one time to an audience and I got a sustained applause. At least they knew I was sleeping. We worried about weapons of mass destruction and there are other forms of terrorism, but you always worry about those kinds of incidents that cause catastrophic loss of life. Loss of one, but catastrophic loss of life. So we worried about various forms of weapons of mass effect. I think the greatest challenge we have today is a vulnerability we have to a biological attack. And I'll tell you why. For 20 or 30 years, we've had a pretty decent public health system, but it's kind of been degraded over the past decade or so. We're starting to build it up a little bit better. But we don't really have a national disease surveillance system that I think, given all the technology that we have and information we could share, we don't have that. We don't have a venue or two, a place to go where they could do ramp up and get everybody working on research or have on a day-to-day research on pathogens that we know that they're experimenting with. And I don't think we have a production capacity. If we needed 300 million antidotes or vaccines, we could ramp it out quickly if it's a contagion. And by the way, Mother Nature could throw a mutant pathogen at you, or a terrorist could. And then how do you distribute it? And the reason I say that is I watched a press conference the other day on H1N1, on the virus, and I'm thinking, now, wait a minute. We've known that this strain would be more virulent. We've known it for over a half a year, And this press conference was being held either at NIH or the National Institute of Health or the Center for Disease Control, and they were proudly boasting that the gap between supply and demand was narrowing. We have work to do. I talk a little bit about it in the book. I'm not saying it to be critical. I'm just simply saying that some of the investments, some of the investments we have made in a post-9/11 world and should continue to make will not only help us deal with the next threat, but also help us to become a stronger, safer, healthier, better country. So for us to be smart and invest in public health and embed it with technology so there's enough information to pull that public health officials can identify the onset of something, public-private partnerships where you have the capacities. The private sector pharmaceutical companies aren't going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on research to build products that nobody's going to buy unless there's an episode. So why don't we figure out a way to have some of them involved with the public sector and have an ongoing capability, and then we have to work out the distribution system. So I slept well, not much, and I still, the biggest concern I think we have is a longer-term biological threat. Okay, gentlemen. Oh, yes, sir.
Thank you for coming and speaking to us. My question has to do with what you said about transparency and how that can ensure that the government doesn't abuse its powers as far as infringing on privacy. And going beyond that, like for instance, like in the cases of the State Secrets Act and other classified actions the public won't know about for some time, and even members that could hold them accountable won't know about for some time. What role do you think accountability plays in this, in ensuring that, one, that we live up to what our Constitution says are our standards, and also to discourage future abuses of the power come time?
Good, very good. A couple of wonderful questions in here. Did everybody hear the questions? Okay, very good. Yours are better than mine. I retired, and the FISA controversy bubbled up when it was finally revealed that the president had authorized the electronic intercept, and there's allegations one way or the other they did or did not talk to the intelligence community. But I remember, and I mentioned this in the book, that I was asked if I would publicly support the president's legal interpretation of his authority to do that in the post 9/11 world. And I said I would. I also said that if they asked me a follow-up question, you'd always anticipate what the journalists are going to ask you to follow up. If I felt that the president should go up and work with Congress so that there was broader knowledge by the Congress of the United States who had oversight over FISA, and that I would, and I told these folks that I felt, as a former congressman, that they should do that. And initially, they chose not to, and they never chose to ask me to go defend it. Not a criticism, I never got up to the president. Well, as it turned out later, there were Republican colleagues of mine in both the House and the Senate said, come on, the administration, you got to come up here. We know what you're doing. We're not going to disagree with you in terms of using your emergency powers, but we also have congressional constitutional responsibility to exercise oversight. So that's the first level of accountability. The second challenge that we confronted in the department, I think it's seminal to your question, is how much information do we share with all of you? First of all, I think much of the information I've seen is overclassified. I think the law enforcement and the intelligence community will put something secret, top secret, et cetera, so they don't have to share it, when in fact I've looked at it, and I'm not an intelligence expert, but I could tell you I don't think that they're going to compromise sources, methods, or anything if at least I use this and tell the chief of police, the mayor, whatever. So that is an area where I think Congress has to look at so we could share more information. Then finally, to your point, the broader issue is that one of the challenges that I talk a little bit about when I wrote about my experience is there's a clash of cultures between the new department in the new norm of a potential terrorist attack and the old departments in the context of the Cold War. The mindset of the intelligence community and law enforcement community historically before 9/11 was need to know. If you need to know, I'll tell you. And by the way, Sometimes they'd say, but you'll never need to know, so don't stand by the phone. We're not going to probably talk to you. We said, not only do we need to know, we need to share. So your point about accountability and transparency is a good one, because I think in the post-9/11 world, for the ability for American, for us to act in a responsible way, consistent with our Constitution, and maybe ask citizens or other people to do things either in preparation of or in response to a threat, they need to know more. We should be sharing more information with the general public. It builds in trust. That's why privacy and security and secrecy, there's always that element. We should always be a little bit mistrustful about what we don't know. We've got good, well-intentioned people, but that's... So I think that whole notion of accountability, in part, and the concern about it is diffused if we're a little bit more forthcoming with the general public about what we're doing and why. Sir.
Oh, thank you for coming, Secretary Ridge. Just a question, not only pertaining to national security, but just in terms of government and society and the judicial system as a whole. A, do you agree with the Griswold versus Connecticut decision that there is a constitutional right to privacy? And if so, under what circumstances should that right be compromised? Are there circumstances, just the right of the community to be safe, or other circumstances that are you see as paramount to that right to privacy, if you believe it exists, according to the Griswold decision?
Well, I'm going to defer to the judges, but there are several here. But I think in response to that question, first of all, the scholars say it's penumbral; it's embedded, even though there's nothing specific in the Constitution about it. It has been defended, but the defense of it really depends on the circumstances of each case and each transaction. But I think the bottom line is that for purposes of homeland security and my responsibility, the notion that the Congress of the United States for the first time in a post-9/11 world said this issue is so important that we better put somebody inside the Department of Homeland Security that can help the Secretary and can reflect our concern that the rights of privacy are not violated. And that's one of the reasons when we went out to get that other information, we made it a voluntary program. But I think how you, I think it's not enumerated, but it is embedded. And I think the circumstances will dictate, and I dare say they probably be rare when it can be violated. Certainly no violation if you voluntarily surrender that. But it's like the woman who said to me, I don't care, you can listen into my conversations. I said, no, they can't. They shouldn't. You don't voluntarily surrender that. And I think you've got to be very careful when you voluntarily surrender anything about you that's private. If you do, it's your business. But I think you've got to be careful when you do it. Sir, we got one up there. We need a microphone here.
Thanks so much for coming. I hope you'll pardon a rather abstract question, but perhaps it can be taken in the context of this Constitution.
I'm not hearing very well.
I wanted to ask if, in your opinion, do you think that a world based on a constituency of nation states is ultimately more secure or less secure for individuals?
Help me out. I didn't hear part of it. What's the question?
A world based on constituency states, is it more secure or less secure?
A world based on what?
Constituent states.
Oh.
Constituent
states. What's your major? Well, certainly we've seen their cause of great instability these days. An instability normally generates conflict, some of which is violent, which ultimately means we're probably not as safe as we want to be. But, you know, again, I guess it's anecdotal. And it's a real challenge, particularly as the force of globalization, communication, information... particularly in certain parts of the world where there's no sense of, I mean, when we think of statism or nationalism, we think in terms of our own experience. But there are places around the world, technically states, sovereigns, that there's not that state of, that sense of nationalism does not exist. I mean, one of the challenges, I think, in parts of the world, not completely, but that they're more, it could be more tribal rather than national. It'd be more ethnic. It could be religious. And so the very nature of those groups becoming like little constituency states is very problematic. And I'm not sure there's an answer. I think it does create instability, which in time does create greater, maybe not international threats, but greater regional threats. Hope I answered your question. I don't know if you just gave me a test of my time, and I maybe get a B+, B minus, something like that. But it's a great question. Great question. The gentleman right here needs a microphone. Maybe you don't.
I think I can do okay without the microphone.
Yeah, so far, so good.
If for some strange reason President Obama called you tomorrow morning and said, look, before I decide the question on Afghanistan, I'd like to get some of your input. What would you tell him and why?
Well, I'd be honored if the president called, but I'm not going to wait by the phone. I'd say, Mr. President, with great respect, I don't think discussing war strategy publicly is in anybody's best interest. I mean, I can't imagine the history of our country. We've actually had military commanders and politicians talking about what we ought to do in a theater of conflict or combat. So I'd say, let's get it off the front page. Secondly, I would probably disagree with his vice president and say, Mr. President, respectfully, I know you have a great deal of respect for Vice President Joe Biden, but the notion that you could go after al-Qaeda and let Taliban take over is just something that I think is wrong. They're kind of intertwined. Maybe different objectives, but they're forces for instability in the region, and I just don't know how you can segregate one from the other. And thirdly, I would say to him that looking for a political compromise is... I would say, Mr. President, divorce yourself of political implications. Do what you think is right. If you believe your military commander, General McChrystal, is right and he wants 40 or 60,000 troops, then you give him the troops. If it's consistent with you think our long-term strategy is and our long-term needs. I mean, I think he needs to articulate it publicly once he decides what he's going to do. Like I said before, the young man up there asked me about accountability and transparency. What are our objectives? I think I know what they are, but I'm not president. What are our objectives? You need to be very clear about that in yourself, and once you're clear about it in your own head, in your own heart, then make the decision accordingly, and then tell the rest of the country. I talked to a good friend of mine who's a heck of a warrior. He's a great soldier. He's a SEAL team leader. He's been over there 5 or 6 times. These guys do some remarkable things. As a matter of fact, he was involved with it. They took the pirates down. Remember? Pirates off the coast of Somalia? I won't tell you about that, but I got some riveting details. Absolutely fascinating what we did there. But he's on his way over with his team. We had a conversation 2 weeks ago. He was born about 48 hours. He said, what's going on out there in Washington? What are you talking about compromising strategy for? I said, well, I'm talking to the wrong guy, but actually we have people saying, well, is there a middle ground? Well, there's no middle ground. What's the strategy? What are your objectives? And give the troop, and if you don't think we can achieve your objectives, let's bring them home. But it's risk management, and this is an interesting question. If you've studied risk management, that whole concept. And I think the president's probably struggling with this. This is a bright guy. I hope he's struggling. I think he's probably struggling. What's the risk if we pull out? Think about it. Taliban gain control? Good chance, if not the entire country, but a significant part of it. Would al-Qaeda, which is already in Pakistan, that's another problem, but would you find them back to their training camps and would this be a safe haven for them? Good possibility. Reemergence of the Taliban, restructuring of al-Qaeda, then what is the chance that that combination in time and the training they do, and they send out their zealots, the jihadists to the rest of the world, are we willing to take that risk? Are you willing to risk another 9/11? Now, I really don't think that they're going to be able to turn commercial airliners into missiles, but that's it. That's part of his challenge. I mean, it's a tough job. I think he's probably discovered, now that he's getting the day-to-day briefings, how tough the job it is. But I'd say, anybody that talks about political implications, kick them out of the room. They're not about politics. Figure out what you want to do, why you want to do it, be prepared to articulate it to the country, and whatever your decision is, bingo. Personally, I think you ought to give McChrystal the troops he needs. Very interesting. I was at the Kennedy School for Government. I went there as an undergraduate. They invited me back. Obviously, they didn't look at my grades, but I went back anyhow. And General Petraeus was there. And I canceled the afternoon because he gave a lecture. And what he did is he put down some of the lessons that he had. I mean, this guy is a scholar warrior. He's really smart. Chest full of distinction. He gets it. And some of the lessons he learned that he applied in Iraq, we learned the other kind. We went the other way in Vietnam. I looked at it and I said, well, I wish we'd have done that when I was there. I wish we'd have done that when I was there. And so we have really thoughtful thinking about how you build, how you deal with this kind of threat in these countries. So at the end of the day, I think you ought to listen to his military commanders. But even before he listens to them, he has to understand clearly in his own mind why he wants our country to be there and deploy the troops that he thinks needs in order to get the job done, then articulate it to a country. And anybody that says, Mr. President, well, politically that may or may not be acceptable, I'd kick him out of the room. I might even fire him. It's not about politics. That discussion around 60,000 men and women over there is just, it's beneath the, and I don't think it'll happen, but if it did, I'd kick him out of the room. Time for a couple more questions.
Yeah, my question is in regards to the promotion of America as a market with the value system as the brand. The use of private military groups such as Blackwater USA have been purveyed abroad for a number of years. And more recently, they've actually also been utilized domestically in a small Midwestern towns. So my question is, what is your stance of the act of placing the charge of defending the Constitution in the hands of corporations whose chief concern is the bottom line?
Whew! I love coming to colleges and universities. Unvarnished, unblemished. Great question. Tough answer. We don't have the size of the military in the very complex combat environment, particularly in Afghanistan and to a certain extent in Iraq, to be able to do all the things that you might want and I might want the military to do. We just don't. So we have contracted some of that out. I would rather see most of that stuff being done by our military, but we don't have that capability. So I guess the question of is are they essential to our broader mission? I think they are. Do we have the capability within the military to provide the service? I don't think we do. Then if we're going to contract out, should we hold them to... I just got done talking about the brand. Then I think we ought to hold them to the same rules of engagement and the same standards we hold our military to. I know there have been some very serious allegations and some charges against some of these private contractors. I've kind of lost track of them because they kind of disappeared after they're on the front page for a while, so I don't know what transpired. But I do think that under the circumstances as we see them now in Afghanistan and Iraq, we don't have the forces to do anything but use private contractors to provide some of these services. I remember when I was in Vietnam, they had private contractors in the back, and that's when we had much, much bigger army, but they had private companies in the back working in the bases and providing electricity and doing those things. But you're talking about we actually have them in a theater of war. They're armed and they're out as a semi-militia. And I agree with you. I think it is, some of the allegations are troubling. I just don't think under the circumstances there's any other alternative. Probably unsatisfied. By the way, what do you think? It was a great question. I mean, they may know an easy answer. Do you have a particular thought about it?
Well, I understand abroad that there may not be an alternative, but more importantly, I believe, what about your stance on domestically? They've been used as private military groups over towns, like several towns in the Midwest, and they've actually...
Frankly, I think it's a good question. I'm not comfortable using the military in law enforcement domestically in the United States. I'm just not. Never have been, never will. The Posse Comitatus statute, they don't really have the authority to arrest unless there's an extreme emergency. But again, those are decisions. The deployment of those paramilitary people by those communities are political decisions. They are made by elected officials who are accountable to their citizens. And so there's abuses by those people, those individuals, and potentially you've got the officials who chose that way to deal with whatever problem was, you hold them accountable. If you need more police on the beat, then gut it up and find the money and put more police on the beat. Go out and hire private contractors.
But as far as abroad, what's to stop the private military organizations from offering a much better and much more convenient way for the young people in this country of serving the same military actions and still defending the country? However, the gear is much better, the pay is much better, but the actions are the same, and also minus the fact that there's no actual oath to defend the Constitution.
What? It is, one of my great concerns about our military is, and you've just identified it, there's a lot of young men and women, by the way, who put their lives at risk, very modest wages, and once their commitment's over, they can go work for one of these private sector companies, probably be involved in slightly less risky, perilous duty, and make more money. So what's that tell you about your military? We might be able to keep more in if we paid them more and treated them better. So it all comes down to a numbers game. You need X number of people to do X number of jobs, be it overseas and domestic, and we have traditional institutions that used to provide those services. Do we have the courage and say, okay, here's the money, here's the budget, we're going to increase the numbers, or are we just going to sidestep it and look the other way? I don't know the answer to that, but political figures at the local level are accountable. But I don't like the notion of using the military. One more? I'm sure I didn't answer your question as well as you wanted, but I think it's a good one, and one that will, again, we'll balance it. Good opening question. Final question? Tyler. You getcha.
Yes, I was just wondering, we've been talking a lot about where the line is between private liberties and increasing our security, and you also mentioned the idea of a national identification card.
Yeah.
In your personal opinion, and maybe also with regards to constitutionality of the issue, where do you think we should move with that issue?
Great question. Now, here's the question. I'm an advocate. I personally would not be uncomfortable if we had a national identification card. Now, that just sends a chill up the back of many, many people who think it's the ultimate invasion of privacy. Now, let me say at the outset, I may be more susceptible to the notion because the government knows just about everything. Thank goodness, not everything, but just about everything about me possible. I mean, I've been fingerprinted a dozen times. I have my photograph taken. They got blood samples. They got everything about me. So the fact that I would have a national ID card that has my fingerprints and a digital photograph and this and that doesn't bother me at all. Some people, and so what I call for in the book, I think we ought to have that debate. I mean, again, we've talked about the transparency that I think is called for by our Constitution. We need to have these civil and civic debates. Here's my feeling about this. Would it help combat terrorism? Oh, I think a little bit. Would it help combat illegal immigration? I think so. Would it help combat crime? To a certain extent, I think it would. Would it help to combat fraud against the government? No question about it. Would it help to combat identity theft? So there are a lot of pluses. And I am of the belief that biometrics used the right way protect your privacy. It does not invade it. So then the question becomes, and I guess if I could wave a magic wand to start the discussion, I'd have the ACLU. I'd have the manufacturers. I'd have the Republicans. Let's start having a discussion about it. But I certainly think that at the end of the day, when the information is given to the government about you on that national ID card, it doesn't have to be much. It really just says you are who you say you are. Now, that's not a bad thing. We're not asking to give the government credit information. You're not asking the government anything, in my judgment, on the national ID card other than a verification that you are a United States citizen and you are who you say you are. That's a good start. Some people somehow think that's an invasion of privacy. I don't, but I think we ought to start the discussion. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you. This was an enormous favor to Dickinson College that Governor Ridge agreed to appear for this speech, because he is in great demand, as you can now tell, across the United States. I must tell you, as he told the story about getting in a car, or getting in the back seat of a car that didn't exist anymore, I talked to him shortly after he left office in January of 2005. And he was driving his own car, and he was talking on the cell phone. I could hear horns honking in the background, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he was driving himself and talking on the cell phone. I said, "Either pull over or pay attention to what you're doing." He was not used to handling his cell phone. He wasn't texting, but he was
Thank you, Your Honor.
His cell phone at the same time. He's much better at it now after a couple of years in the private sector. Andrew, you're going to close it out? Is that correct? Let's give Governor Ridge another hand, please.
Yeah, thanks, all. Very good.
I just wanted to add my thanks again for coming. Thank you for your service to our country.
You're welcome, Andrew.
Also, a reminder, we'll be having a reception in the Social Hall of the Holland Union Building starting at 6:30, and anyone with a Dickinson ID or invitation is invited. So thank you very much, and enjoy your evening.